This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Today, we're going to get a glimpse at the drug trade, the war on drugs, and international relations between the U.S. and Mexico. Journalist Charles Bowden is our guest. He examines these issues in his new book, Down by the River, Drugs, Money, Murder, and Family. Jordan reports in depth on one murder and how it has affected a large, tight-knit, and proud Italian-Mexican-American family. The murder was committed in the parking lot of a busy store in El Paso in 1995. The murdered man was Lionel Bruno Jordan. At the time of the murder, one of Bruno Jordan's brothers, Phil, had worked for the Drug Enforcement Agency for close to 30 years. Phil Jordan was about to become the head of EPIC, the El Paso Intelligence Center, home to more than 300 narcotics agents. The police had a suspect and a motive immediately. The police said it was a botched carjacking, and a 13-year-old kid from Juarez, Mexico, was arrested and convicted of the crime. But was that all there was to it? Hardly. The boy was offered a tremendous deal if he would identify the people behind the murder. No deal could be made. Charles Bowden's new book, Down by the River, Drugs, Money, Murder, and Family, is published by Simon & Schuster. He's also the author of 11 previous books of nonfiction, including Blood Orchid and the Sonoran Desert. Listeners, you are invited to join us this afternoon with your questions and comments. Join us with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Charles Bowden, good afternoon. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Sure. You note early in the book, most of us are unaware of the vastness of the drug trade. You say it's something that's a problem that's always placed on the other side of town or the other side of a line or the other side of the river. But you say this could be the major American story of our era.
I think so, for several reasons.
Yeah, what are the major themes of this story?
Well, the drug industry is very simple. It's multi-billion dollars. It's huge. It kills a lot of people, I think. The war on drugs has killed more people than any American foreign policy initiative since the Vietnam War. And thirdly, it's created the highest prison population in the history of the world, our own. We tend to think it's some sort of vice that doesn't touch us, and yet it permeates our society, and we're oblivious to it. Mexico alone earns $30 billion cash a year from drugs. We make a lot more. The money's in our banks, businesses everywhere. But I think we've been like an ostrich with our head in the sands. The other thing is we're in a trap. But we don't like to admit it, that we can't stop people from taking drugs, and we can't. The problem hasn't gone away. Mexico needs the money, and as a government, we're dependent on a stable Mexico. And so, in a sense, we fight a war in a series of skirmishes, but never pursue it because the costs of pursuing it are too high.
Hmm. What does this half-hearted, if I could use that way to describe it, this half-hearted effort mean to the men and women who are asked to wage it?
Well, look at it. The war on drugs is very real if you're a law enforcement official and someone shoots you. It's very real if you're an addict and they put you in prison. And it's very real if you're a drug dealer and somebody puts a bullet through the back of your head. I don't mean to claim that there isn't a lot of actual misery. For cops, it's frustrating. Every DEA agent that rises can tell you a story of an investigation stopped because it went too high, particularly if they deal with Mexico. Almost all investigations stop once they start leading into the Mexican government. And I've talked to agent after agent in this area, and they all have a little list of when they were stopped because our foreign policy goals supersede our police or law enforcement goals. So basically, if you talk to DEA agents, you're talking to a frustrated group of people. Phil Jordan is an example. He gave 30 years of his life to DEA. He was an exemplary agent. He rose to had the largest narcotics intelligence center on the surface of the earth. And when his brother is murdered, he can get absolutely no help from his own government. They just turned a blind eye. and was left out there dangling in the wind almost to pursue it himself.
Hmm.
And this reality eventually destroyed his career, his marriage, and many other parts of his life. It was a disaster for his family. I should say this is a storybook family. The Jordan family has at least 500 members in El Paso alone. It's a huge extended family. And, of course, this killing was like a shot below the waterline. I mean, it just devastated all of them.
Hmm. Now, tell us about these brothers, Bruno and Phil Jordan, two brothers, the youngest and oldest sons in a family.
Well, it's odd. Bruno was the child born after the family was finished. His closest sibling was 11 or 12 years old when he was born. Phil was already an adult. But Bruno is that special child that families have sometimes, the golden child.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not only that everyone liked him. It's that his older siblings actually looked up to him, come to him to consult for his judgment.
Mm-hmm.
He was the apple of everyone's eye. If Phil had been murdered, given the life he'd chosen, of working undercover in narcotics enforcement, the family would have grieved and moved on. But for Bruno to be murdered, a 27-year-old who sold suits, was engaged to be married, and about to enter law school, was like a violation of everything they'd been led to believe about themselves and their country. They simply couldn't accept it.
Yeah. And
I never met anyone who just liked Bruno Jordan. I mean, I spent a lot of time trying to find, you know, the feet of clay type of thing to explain his death. He apparently was just one of those absolutely decent, sunny individuals that once in a while we're all graced to meet.
Yeah. He's a guy that would do anything to help you out.
Yes, and he had nothing to do with the drug world. Absolutely nothing, you know, that he had no connection with his older brother's career. And, of course, his older brother had to feel tremendous guilt because in the end he had to believe at some level that his brother had been murdered because of him.
Mm-hmm.
And that the blood was on his hands. I'll make it simple. He had to face the fact that he'd brought this to his family, like a plague to his kinfolk.
Yeah.
And it just devastated him. I mean, in the course of the book, which took me 7 years, I became quite close to the family and very close to Phil, the older brother. And this was just a ruination. He went to the FBI and others. DEA forbid him to investigate it. The FBI and other agencies wouldn't look into it. So Phil started taking his savings secretly without telling his wife and financing a private investigation. And then to make up the losses, the tens of thousands he was spending out of his children's college fund, he started gambling. You know, I will replace it. And, of course, that led to ruin. Eventually he went bankrupt. His wife left him, et cetera.
Yeah, and
he was a straight arrow. He was a guy who's never had more than one beer at one time in his life, never smoked a cigarette, you know, was a college basketball star, and had spent his life outside of law enforcement doing things like running drug-free youth leagues for basketball, et cetera.
Mm.
I mean, what you're dealing with here is Dudley Do-Right, you know, just an absolutely decent, straight guy, you know. And so that he had anticipated retiring in his early 50s with a nice federal pension after 30 years' work and becoming a consultant. Instead, he became a man obsessed with his brother's murder, with what he believed is his brother's blood on his hands, scrambling to make money to try and solve the crime and replace the money he'd spent investigating it. This was the ruination of him. If Bruno Jordan had not been murdered, none of these things would have happened to Phil Jordan.
Yeah. And then also it was Bruno who said to his brother, go for it. Go for this becoming the head of this intelligence center.
Oddly enough, his brother, who was, you know, 25 years younger than him, was, like with the other siblings, Phil's advisor, the person he'd consult with because he trusted his judgment. And you have to, your listeners have to, I should tell them, that Bruno Jordan was murdered 3 days before Phil was to assume command of this intelligence center in El Paso. It was a kind of striking coincidence, if it were one. And the largest drug organization, and certainly the most successful in the history of the world, was just across the river from El Paso in Juarez. The Juarez cartel which by 1995, when Bruno was murdered, was earning by DEA estimate, conservatively earning $200 million a week. This is not some punks on the corner. This is something the size of a major corporation hauling in $10 billion or more a year, mm-hmm. with thousands of soldiers that work for it, meaning members of the cartel.
Yeah. Well, one of the many chilling aspects of this story can be summed up in a sentence you use on a couple of occasions in the book. Anyone can be more than one person.
Yeah.
And the drug world is kind of like a black hole. And the good guys can be related to bad guys.
Oh, yes. It's most of the police worked, at least in some sense, for the cartel, or they couldn't function. Most of the murders, drug murders in Juarez, or many of them, were committed by the federal and state police under contract for the drug cartel. Many of them were committed by the Army. And so you get in the shadow zone. I don't think there's anyone in El Paso and Juarez, if they're candid, who doesn't, in some sense, know someone involved in the drug business. And that doesn't mean most of the people in El Paso and Juarez are crooked or corrupt. They're not. It's just an omnipresent reality, like living in Al Capone, Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, by the sort of purest standards some people have, then no one's clean. And, you know, Phil was raised, as were his siblings, in a barrio 5 blocks from the river. His grandfather had businesses in both El Paso and Juarez. But he had come out of this world and kind of escaped it into a professional career with the U.S. government, being stationed here and there. And then his brother's murder pulled him back in to this world he thought he'd left.
Mm-hmm.
And as I say, it was devastating for him.
Yeah.
And for everyone else in the family.
Yeah, for a lot of other folks in the
well,
family.
Part of what devastated him was Phil Jordan was a kind of man who gave the private briefings to Attorney General Janet Reno and figures of that level. But he couldn't get any help when his brother was murdered, you know. And it's because the murder led into Mexico and led into the Mexican government. And once that happens, cooperation stops for the reasons I mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm.
But it's more important to the United States to have a stable partner on our southern border than to expose corruption in the government of Mexico. And so Phil felt like he'd been cheated, like after a lifetime of service, no one cared what happened to him or his family. And then as an addition to the tragedy, Phil's cousin, Salvador Martinez, was also a DEA agent. And he secretly, unbeknownst to Phil, entered in a murder contract to kill the purported murderer, Bruno Jordan, and was caught in an FBI sting and is now doing 84 months in a federal prison. So the tragedy for this extended family doesn't seem to ever end.
Yeah.
It's like, oddly enough, the only end of it, in a sense, is the book. And by that, I mean, I'm not being presumptuous that I did something wonderful, but at least there's a record. At least, unlike the thousands of killings on the border, at least this one is on paper and hasn't been erased as if it never happened.
Yeah.
That's about all the solace you get when you live on the line.
Yeah. What kind of reaction is the book getting on the border?
Well, so far, it's getting very good reviews. The Chicago Tribune gave it a good review, et cetera. But it's a little early. It was just published November 8th. And oddly enough, like, I got a letter from a drug dealer in El Paso, Juarez, thanking me for the book. And you'd have to understand, this guy had done 2 stretches in prison, and it's an individual I don't know. You have to understand that if you were in this industry, which is multi-billion,
mm-hmm.
you can read newspapers and it doesn't exist. And so the book for a person such as this individual is a confirmation of this kind of nightmare world he'd lived in, as if it really did happen. And that's why he wrote me the letter, a kind of, you know, thank you note
mm-hmm.
for recording it. After that, look, between 1993 and 2001, 2,800 people were either murdered or vanished in Juarez. And it's like it never happened. To my knowledge, there's never, and certainly up to a year ago, there had never been an arrest in Juarez for a drug murder. And so the Jordan family is just one family of many families who have lost people, and it's simply beneath public comment and often beneath public record. There's not even a newspaper story. They just disappear into this charnel house created by the drug industry.
It's a dangerous story to tell.
Well, at times. I'll put it this way. One has to stay alert at times. As I was kidding someone yesterday, I spent 7 years writing about the drug world, but could never afford the indulgence of trying a drug. I had to stay alert. So, but this is a global thing. I mean, drugs are huge globally. The United Nations variously estimates it is 8 to 12% of global trade, and the reason it's so high is the material has such high value. But as I say, we turn a blind eye. The Salinas administration ran from 1988 to 1994. During that period, the president of Mexico's brother, Raul, we know shipped about $400 million to foreign bank accounts in New York and in Switzerland. At that time, he was earning a salary of $190,000 a year. And this was, just sort of minor bribes from the drug business. And then January of 1997, Amado Carrillo, who ran the Juarez cartel, sent a message to the president of Mexico that if he didn't stop, unless he was left alone to pursue his business, he would take his business and leave Mexico and locate it somewhere, thereby leading to the economic collapse of Mexico.
Yeah, this is a really good question. If suddenly there was no drug trade, how would Mexico be changed?
Well, to start with, it would go through a severe economic crisis. Drugs are in Mexico, our government estimates, from $27 to $32 billion a year. Petroleum is Mexico's leading legal export or source of currency, earns it about $8 billion a year. If you take the three leading sources of foreign currency in Mexico, petroleum, tourism, and remittances, money sent back by Mexicans working in the United States, and you combine those three figures, they're still less than the $30 billion a year. American investment in Mexico, legitimate, runs at the most $5 to $10 billion a year. So the $30 billion a year is our largest investment in Mexico, and what we're giving it to are murderous scum in the drug industry and corrupt government officials. Mm. It's a sort of bizarre development plan we've inadvertently entered into. Mm. And, of course, it's totally denied, DEA will never say out loud what I have them saying in the book because they're not allowed to. You're not allowed to question the government of Mexico, nor have they ever. In 1994, the head of the Narcotics Intelligence Center that Phil Jordan eventually ran said publicly that the Mexican government was corrupt, and he was dismissed within days, just automatically retired. That's the policy of our government.
Yeah. What would have to happen for the secrecy to come to an end, particularly in Mexico?
Well, what I want to end is the secrecy here. Actually, they're making bigger strides than we are. You have to understand, in Mexico, for the new reform government, for example, President Fox, to really get serious about the war on drugs about the drug industry would threaten its very survival. I mean, I think they'd be killed. In the United States, I think what we have to do personally is acknowledge what this is costing us. One-third to one-half of the inmates in our prisons are in there for drug offenses. DEA has expanded from about 400 agents in 1965 to close to 5,000 today. Our current drug budget for state, local, and federal narcotics officers is $30 billion a year. That we've created a monster. And at the same time, any narcotics enforcement agent will tell you that drugs have never been more prevalent and they've never been at a lower price in our cities. Now, if you look at these numbers, you have to wonder why you're pursuing a policy that's such a failure, besides the fact it's getting a lot of people killed. that's getting them killed over materials that in and of themselves have very, very little value. I mean, most of these drugs can be produced for very little money. The only reason there's a lot of money in drugs is that they're illegal. The other thing you have to consider is it's very hard to convince people not to use them because people feel better when they use them. We're in a society that can't even get people to stop being alcoholics, really. We're not going to be very successful telling them not to take chemicals that make them feel better, nor have we been. Mm-hmm. But I don't think we've made a real serious dent in drug use, or are we likely to. What we've done is like legalizing gambling. We unconsciously have legalized mind-altering drugs with all these antidepressants that are advertised now on our televisions. Mm-hmm. And we have this other group that we still consider outlaw drugs. Marijuana is a perfect example. We're arresting 500,000 people a year for simply possessing marijuana in this country.
Yet the government is really adamant about keeping marijuana illegal.
No, I know. Well, look, even these medical referendums, and I live in Arizona, where we've voted two or three times to legalize it for medical purposes, is fought by the federal government. Also, you know, there's a vested interest in the war on drugs. Fighting the war on drugs is a huge industry. I mean, the prison system in our country is now a huge industry. In the year 2000, when the referendum was on the ballot in California to essentially decriminalize marijuana for people with medicinal needs, particularly chemotherapy, the largest single source of contributions to fight that referendum came from the Prison Guards Union, which is kind of a clear, you know, blatant self-interest. We've got a huge prison establishment that feeds off it. We have a huge therapy industry where people, instead of going to jail or prison, elect mandatory therapy. And then we have an incredible police establishment, and I haven't even touched on RICO, meaning, you know, the racketeering statute, where, you know, they essentially, if you are found guilty of a drug offense, they can seize all your assets, and do. Yeah. I mean, there are jurisdictions here where it's like a gravy train for the police department. So what I think, and what I think people should consider, is not whether drugs are good, not whether they want a population that's sitting around smoking pot, but whether this war is more damaging to us than drug use itself. I think it is, but I think that is the question, not how do we win the war. We can't stop drugs from coming into this country. The Mexican-U.S. border, for example, legally, is the most heavily trafficked border on Earth. Over 250 million human beings legally cross it every year. There's one bridge in El Paso where 600,000 semis enter the United States every year. It is preposterous to think you're going to keep drugs out or be able to search even a tiny part of this. I would say the vehicles crossing the Mexican border, less than 5% are even examined. What that means is if you were smuggling drugs in and you just stuffed them in every car and they searched 5%, 95% of your loads would get through. We have a case from 1989 where we know that one drug syndicate sent 900 shipments across one bridge in El Paso and never lost a single load. And, of course, the border, in a sense, is more open now after the North American Free Trade Agreement, which has increased commerce between our two nations, which means it's increased the number of containers and places going back and forth where you can put drugs. So what I'm telling you is you will never, interdiction will hurt drug dealers, but it will never stop the importation. The only thing that would stop the importation of drugs into the United States is if the citizens of the United States stop buying them.
Not going to happen anytime soon.
Well, not apparently not. I mean, our government keeps announcing statistics how they're making gains, and yet the drugs become more and more common. So you have to wonder why Colombians and Mexicans are risking their lives to bring hundreds of tons of drugs into our society when our government claims people don't use them anymore. This is simply not believable.
Yeah. I've got a couple of listeners who want to join the conversation. Sure. But before I do that, I want to ask you this question. Here's Phil Jordan, straight arrow guy, DEA, 30 years plus.
Essentially a giant Boy Scout.
Right, okay. Sitting down, talking with him, what would he say about, you know, bringing some sanity to this
situation? He wouldn't agree with me, and I'll tell you why.
Okay.
One, he thinks we've never made a wholehearted effort.
Mm-hmm.
Two, he just can't stomach the idea of drugs.
Mm-hmm.
But three, it's sort of on the second cup of coffee type of thing,
mm-hmm.
talking. He thinks what we're doing is a bankruptcy. Do you follow? Start with, all these guys, you know, in DEA, almost all of them, and the personnel, would take marijuana off the table. Essentially, no matter what you call it, decriminalize it.
Mm-hmm.
They do have a passion for the hard drugs. And frankly, there's very few people that look out in the street and hope more people become addicted to heroin
mm-hmm.
or have a bad cocaine habit. But Phil thinks he spent risked his life for decades in a battle that he was never really allowed to try and win. And many people of his generation in DEA believe that.
Let's talk with those listeners. First, we're going to go to a caller on line one in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Yeah, I'd like to, earlier you mentioned that most of the money is made on our side of the border. And I know that in a recent article in the Rocky Mountain News, you quoted a Mexican study that speculated that if the drug business vanished, the U.S. economy would shrink by 19% to 22%.
Yes.
And which I think is probably right on the money.
I don't know. It may be too high. I put it in there for two reasons. One, when you read the studies governments do on the drug business, they always have it as much larger than they state publicly.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, no one really knows the size of the drug business because it's absolutely underground. The only thing we know is when we get little glimpses. Like there was a period, I believe, in the first 10 days of 1997 when the U.S. government suddenly tracked $6 billion in 10 days that was dirty money leaving Mexico and sort of went reeling at the enormity of what this implied. So that, going back to it, all we know is the drug business is very large. It's larger than any legitimate business in Mexico.
Well, it's also quite large here.
I'll give you an example. If I give you a kilo of cocaine in Juarez, and you can make it across a bridge that's 100 yards long, the kilo is worth four times as much.
Uh-huh.
Instantly.
Well, I'm just wondering if you, what you could say exactly. I mean, it seems to me that
how bad
Americans are kind of uneasy about turning their lookout for corruption on their own. They seem to see corruption as kind of like, like this kind of, they were just fooling around kind of thing. You know, they don't really have a serious ability to look upon their own activities. And I was just wondering if you had any insight into how it is all this money could be made on this side of the border and hidden so easily. That's what I'd like to know.
Well, to start with, nobody looks for it. I'll give you a couple of examples. One, I know that DEA at times has investigated agencies like Customs and INS and essentially been stopped. Anybody that lives on the border, as I do, knows these agencies are riddled with corruption. Secondly, every effort to track the money coming north into U.S. banking is stopped. Operation Casablanca, which was a huge expose of dirty Mexican banks, never tracked the money once it came north of the border, which seems a little bizarre to some of us. And the reason is any money made in a place like Mexico of any consequence eventually winds up in the first world because that's where it's safe, for the same reason the Saudis, for example, invest in Europe and the United States. And so it comes here, and nobody wants to talk about it. The banks in El Paso, for example, and by 1995, were taking in money at $75 million a month above anything the licit economy there could explain. In San Antonio, it was $3 billion a year. In Miami, it was $25 billion a year, et cetera. And nobody, our government has no interest in pursuing that. But what Mexicans get indignant about, justifiably, is the implication that they're a bunch of corrupt people and we're just these poor victims who are plying with drugs. When they point out correctly that most of the money made in drugs is made north of the Rio Grande. This is where the big profits are. And that we won't do anything about it. We just like to blame them.
Hmm. Let's talk with another caller. We're going to go on to a listener on line two, Champaign County. Good afternoon.
Hi. Yeah, those figures about Miami and Juarez and San Antonio, and I guess L.A. is a big...
Yes, it's another center.
Right. I was hearing $10 billion, but I guess maybe that's an older figure.
Oh, look at the... Yes, I don't have current figures. At one point, I read that they couldn't find any money in Los Angeles that wouldn't test for cocaine, which apparently spreads like a plague, meaning, you know, where it wouldn't test positive for it.
Right. Well, some of it is electronically transferred, though I guess cash laundering is a big business, and I don't know what...
Well, it is now. You got to, you know, the Cayman Islands have 30,000 people, and it's the fifth largest banking center on Earth. So, yes, wire transfers, money laundering is a major global industry now.
Right. Well, they have corporations that have charters there for other reasons, too. But
that's part of the problem in reality in stopping this. The very these conduits for laundering money weren't created by drug cartels. They simply follow the conduits the corporations use to limit their tax liabilities. And so when there's efforts to change the laws like a year ago, they generally get shut down, like Senator Graham in Texas led the fight against reforming these regulations, because legitimate corporations like to use them too, apparently to avoid full taxation.
Semi-legitimate, then, let's call them. But I wanted to talk...
Well, they say they're legitimate.
I wanted to talk a bit more about Mexico and the president's brother and that. I mean, the president actually is in... Last I heard was in Ireland because there was no...
Yes, because it has no extradition treaty with Mexico.
Yeah.
Carlos Salinas essentially fled and became a disgraced president when the economy collapsed.
But he was the one that, and you mentioned NAFTA and the increase in funding.
He brought NAFTA in.
And it couldn't be exposed before that. And also the devaluation that happened right after NAFTA was well hidden. There were a lot of financial transactions going on that were hiding that, and disturbing the drug trade would have disturbed, you know, the great neoliberalizing president of Mexico, and it would also disturb
That's
the
right.
economic situation. So,
no, we had a vested interest in getting NAFTA passed, and part of getting NAFTA passed was not questioning the integrity of the Mexican government or the shambles its economy was in when NAFTA did pass. And after Salinas left office, within weeks, the entire economy collapsed, meaning the peso lost at least 50% of its value within weeks. It was a la crisis, they called it, the crisis. It just devastated the people of Mexico. And before the crisis, 50% of the people of Mexico were living below the poverty line. So, yes. The other thing that's sort of curious is that the Chase Manhattan, or the Citibank in New York, handled a lot of this money that Raul Salinas, the president's brother, was sending out of Mexico. And the only call they ever got about the account, according to their official, bank official, was from the president of Mexico. So it's a little hard to believe he didn't know what was going on.
One other thing, I've talked to some Colombians recently, and they talk about not the banking and the laundering, but they talk about the chemical companies that could be traced and followed down.
Oh, you mean the ones that supply chemicals for making meth and that?
Well, also making, refining cocaine out in the countryside. The trade, BASF and European. And,
see, I'm not up on that, but...
Well,
I'm sure it's true. What I mean is everybody, in a sense, with a wink and a nod, knows what's going on.
And, well, that's just another one, just like the banking industry, where there's so-called legitimate corporations that are, you know, don't want to rock the boat, and because they are making quite a bit of money on
that's right.
supplying the cocaine refining.
You know, you can look at the drug business, the industry, and say, well, you know, it's quasi-legitimate, everybody winks. Of course, that's true. until they throw you in prison or kill you. And then suddenly, it's a different matter. But that's one of the problems. You know, having this illegal, I think, is corrupting both our societies.
I want to thank the listener. I want to thank the listener for his call, and I want to go on to another caller who has been waiting for quite a while here on the toll-free line in Atlanta, Illinois. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. This is a disturbing discussion, and probably we all kind of knew what was going on, but your book obviously is you know, just really helpful. But, you know, in reality, there's probably a very easy solution to this whole problem that I've thought about for quite some time, and I think it's practiced in some cases, which I'll tell you in a second, but I think, firstly, we need to take the profit motive out of drugs, and we all know how to do that. That's real simple. And then, you know, for some strategic things like airline pilots and train operators and truck drivers and lots and lots of people in the society can't be running around stoned all the time, that's for sure, although probably would be fun, but it's not a very practical thing. And I know some of my railroad buddies that work for the Canadian National Railroad, they get paid tremendous amounts of money, but they get tested very often for drugs. And I think where drugs should be regulated where it's needed is in the workplace, which takes the federal government completely out of it. And if you've got a job sensitive to your thinking or sensitive to operating equipment or whatever you're doing, it can be regulated at the workplace, and otherwise, you know, decriminalize the whole process. And I think then we could work on why do people like to take drugs, and we could solve some of those problems that way. But I think if businesses got behind doing it that way and we got the federal government out of it, it'd be great. What do you think?
Well, I think, you know, that's an interesting point. You know, we actually have a model, both of how to have a failed policy and how to have a better one. And it's our historic war against alcohol. Now, alcohol is legal, but we basically, if you want to be drunk all the time, you can't run the train or fly the plane.
That's right. They're tested, along with other drugs, they're tested for alcohol. And, I mean,
we know how to do this. It's just there's a lot of scare tactics, like, my heavens, if this stuff were available, what would happen to us? Well, the same thing that's happened to us with alcohol. And frankly, a lot of these drugs are more benign, as I, in my more obstreperous moments, tell people. You can't show me the woman who's been beaten on Saturday night because the old man had a joint. But if you're really so concerned about behavior, you'd be focusing on alcohol, which kills far more people by altering their behavior. But I agree with you. I mean, I think what's going to happen is culturally, we are going to have to create norms of behavior that handle drugs, just as we have with alcohol. We have a society now where you can sit in your home in privacy and drink yourself to death, but you can't go driving down the street and do a lot of other things without violating the law. And the same thing will happen with drugs. Drugs are relatively new to our culture, and cultures are very conservative. And so we have tried to keep them out. And what this book is about is the price of doing that and the terrible failure that we've experienced in trying to do that. And so I agree with you. But what we have to do is at least be honest for once, get away from this political rhetoric that politicians use, and face the enormity of the problem, that we are incarcerating millions or hundreds of thousands of our fellow citizens simply because they ingest substances that alter their state of well-being, not because of something they're doing. They're not breaking windows or doing anything else. And we have to ask ourselves, why are we doing this? Why are we throwing people in prison because they want to inject heroin in their veins, for example?
Well, that's right. That's why regulation at the workplace, you give the person the choice.
Right.
Either, you know...
Well, yeah, I'm a perfect example. I am not a saint, but I can't have a worthwhile life and function in the way I like if I'm using drugs or inebriated all the time. So I guess, you know, what they'd have to test me for is black coffee. They need to pour down me.
I'm kind of...
But I am not what you would call clean because of the drug laws. I'm clean because, one, they don't attract me, drugs, but mainly because I want to do things. Mm-hmm. You know, the same reason in a society where alcohol is legal, most of the people you're going to meet today aren't drunk. because they have other goals in life. But they're also not criminals if they do drink, which is, I think, a better way to approach it.
Yeah.
When you get into the medical treatment, I do get intemperate. But I have personally taken care of three people with cancer going through chemotherapy. And anyone that does that eventually goes out on the street and gets marijuana. But this is the dirty little secret of our society, that it's the only thing I know of that actually mitigates the severe nausea of chemotherapy. And I think it is just simply almost obscene to criminalize people trying to help other people through a deadly disease. Mm-hmm. So in that area, I become a little unhinged.
Yeah. Before we have to wrap things up, I want to talk with you a little bit about the kid who shot Bruno. In terms of, you know, here's another place where this is costing us so much. You know,
what he was a poor street kid,
yeah,
who apparently did a job. I mean, you know, that I went and visited his home, which was a cardboard shack in Juarez, without water or electricity, where he was juggling on street corners in El Paso illegally from the age of 9 onward, simply to raise money to feed his family. And so I've never felt any rancor toward him. He is now out of prison because he won on appeal because of a technical failing in the trial, and is allegedly rising in the Juarez cartel. And I suspect he's doing that because he's now bicultural thanks to our prison system, and because that is the way to rise. In a society where there's no work and no wages, many people are tempted by criminal activity, and he's one of them.
Yeah, and that was why he turned down that deal. Tell us about the deal he was offered.
This deal was odd. What he was offered was that all charges would be dropped against him, that all of his mother and all of his siblings would be brought from Juarez to El Paso. They would all be given new identities. They would all be given jobs. They would be relocated and be given citizenship if he would just give the name of the person who drove him into the parking lot for the hit.
Mm-hmm.
And he refused. He's 13 years old, and he turned this down. And what that tells you is a simple, he knew something more terrifying than the U.S. government. He was dealing with something even more frightening to him than being, you know, in the clutches of our justice system.
Mm-hmm.
And what I think he knew was the Juarez cartel. But he thought, if I talked, what's really going to happen is everybody related to me will be murdered.
Right. And
so
if
he turned down the deal and went to prison instead, 13-year-old kid.
Yeah. And now, now he could be a rising star in the cartel.
For a while.
Yeah. Yeah,
there's no Sun City if you're in the drug world. You may rise, but you fall like a meteor eventually. No, not many people make it to retirement that go into that line of work.
Yeah. Our time is up.
Well, thank you for having me.
Charles Bowden, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Okay, it's been a pleasure.
Journalist Charles Bowden has been our guest this afternoon. His book is Down by the River, Drugs, Money, Murder, and Family. The book is published by Simon & Schuster.